Welcome to another ABC Radio National podcast. For more information, go to abc.net.au/rn.
Good morning, Ramona Koval here with The Book Show on ABC Radio National. Shortly, we're off to New York to talk with Columbia University's Hamid Dabashi, Professor of Iranian Studies and Comparative Literature, and his book, A People Interrupted, looking at the sweep of Iranian history through the lens of a cultural critic. And we're continuing our reading by Luis Garcia, Child of the Revolution, about growing up in Castro's Cuba. And we'll review a what-if book by a prominent collection of prominent Australian historians, a collection of counterfactual histories called What If? Australian History as It Might Have Been. But we'll leave Australian history for later and concentrate on the history of one of the oldest civilizations on the planet, that of Persia, which is now known as Iran. Hamid Dabashi is the Hagop Kevorkian Professor of Iranian Studies and Comparative Literature at Columbia University in New York. He's written Authority in Islam, Theology of Discontent, and Close Up, Iranian Cinema, Past, Present and Future, amongst all kinds of other things. But his latest book is Iran, A People Interrupted. And in it, he writes of his country's history. Well, he mentions the past 1,000 years or so, but he focuses on the last 200 years. And he uses the lens of literature to argue for a complexity of understanding that's so much more than we're used to reading since Iran's nuclear ambitions have thrust it once again into the spotlight of history. In fact, in the public discourse, we hear very little about Iran, save that the Shah was deposed, that the Ayatollah Khomeini came to power, that Salman Rushdie was threatened with a fatwa, that Iran's reform movement collapsed, and that its current president, Mohammad Ahmadinejad, is an anti-Semitic Holocaust denier, and that Iran's 70 million people live above one of the largest reserves of oil on the planet, and now that Iran is one of the countries in the axis of evil. So how will we understand all these things? Well, we're going to speak now in New York with Professor Hamid Dabashi, who joins us from a New York studio. Welcome to The Book Show.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Well, your accounts of the history of Iran and before that Persia under a variety of rulers and regimes is not what you might call a happy one. It seems to an outsider that some countries are simply in the wrong geographical place and suffer the histories of being sought after either for themselves, their economics and resource usefulness, or their strategic usefulness on the way to somewhere else. Why was this territory so sought after and fought over?
I think it's a splendid question, but it puts Iran in a passive situation. Iran has never been a passive. As you know, Iran, or what used to be called Persia, is the founder of the first globalized empire under the Achaemenids that ruled over the vast civilized world of the period from Indus Valley to the Mediterranean. From 550 BC to 330 BC, when Alexander the Great ultimately put an end to it. So throughout history, Iran has in fact had quite an active role to play in history. It is only over the last 200 years, with the center of economic and political gravity being shifted to Western Europe, that Iran and practically all its neighbors, ranging from India to North Africa, have become the objects of colonial interest. And as you rightly said, partially because of their strategic location and partially because of their natural resources.
Which were what?
Oil, primarily.
And, you know, you not only talk about European colonialism as causing some deep problems in Iran, but also monarchical corruption over the years, which is internally generated.
Of course, absolutely. It is entirely wrong to blame everything on European colonialism. European colonialism has been a major political factor in global history, not just in Iran or in its neighborhoods, throughout Africa, Asia, Latin America. But things such as monarchical corruption, namely domestic issues pertinent and historical and dominant in these cultures have been equally important. And it is imperative for us to have a dialectical reading of contemporary histories that includes both domestic issues and international foreign issues. Blaming or crediting is not just blaming. Usually, for example, internal corruptions are blamed, and then the process of colonization is credited as westernization. So westernization is good and domestic tyrannies are bad, and thus the paradox or the opposition between two forces, the Manichaean forces of good and evil. One of the things that I have tried to do in my book, in fact, break down this dichotomy and see these two forces, namely forces domestic to a culture such as Iran and forces that come from outside, in a kind of a dialogical conversation that can be as much hopeful and emancipatory as arresting and, in fact, daunting for the people of the region.
And it's looking for this complexity that you have decided to tell the story of Iran by taking what we're talking about, as well as all kinds of history and politics, but about the role and influences of its literature, its poetry, and later its novels and journalism. What mm-hmm. makes you choose this way of telling the story?
Well, I use it by way of the way we daydream our hopes and our aspirations. We are never satisfied with our current material and factual and objective life. We always dream a better life. We always anticipate a better life, and that's how we generate and sustain energy to better our lives. And things ranging from, massive social revolutions to poetry and to prose and cinema and theater and performing arts, visual arts. These are the ways that the nation dreams, its alternatives. And the more arresting, the more daunting, and the more debilitating, in fact, the material and political circumstances, the more flourishing and the more flamboyant, perhaps, are these dreams. So one of the things that I have tried to do in the book is, in fact, navigate through these dreams, historicize them, and give examples of them in each phase of the Iranian history over the last 200 years. We have one of these, for example, poetry of the constitutional period, turn of the century, late 19th century, early 20th century. Poetry becomes much more than beautiful words for pastimes. Poetry is part and parcel of a national liberation movement, and poets are arrested and incarcerated and tortured, and at the same time they're also celebrated, and people have looked up to them for the first of all a description of their status quo, and also for finding ways out of their predicament. So it's a give and take between factual and objective realities and the way that the people give voice and vision to alternative modes of their lives that I thought things such as visual and performing and literary arts are the ways to give a fuller picture of what has happened. Usually literary histories or history of art is done in, not always, but usually in isolation, or primarily attention is paid to these arts and some sort of lip service to the social context. And then alternatively, unfortunately, especially in the Anglo-Saxon world, the political and historical narratives are devoid of any attention to these other aspects of the society. So I've tried to give a more full-bodied account of Iranian society, in which both its political and historical predicament and the manner that it has historically dreamt it's otherwise than reality are part of the fuller picture.
And you say that you've had too many bad kings in your history, and that's perhaps why you have so many good poets.
Exactly. Yes, I mean, I don't think that anybody will doubt that we have had too many bad kings. But the dialectic that I propose there is the issue that precisely because the corruption of the political system and the arrested disposition is not just a question of politically corrupt, but it is intellectually, morally, normatively is arrested, is not going anywhere. that poets have had such a fantastic role to play. And I mean, I don't want to sound too naive that everything about Iran is poetry. Iran has also had very violent revolutions. And also perhaps it would have been better, historically speaking, we had less poet and more causes and reasons to have had these prominent poets. But given the historical fact as it is, we have had the fantastic poets, and these poets have had multiple functions to play. And these poets have also played heavy, heavy prices. There is a wonderful poet in the constitutional period of, when I say constitutional period, is the revolution of 1906-1911. His name is Aref, who in the course of a conversation towards the end of his life, he was bitter that he was not appreciated and praised enough. He said in the course of a conversation that before I began composing my poetry, one in 1,000 Iranians didn't know what the word nation meant. I coined and invented the word nation. And I think he's absolutely correct that because of the popularity of poetry, because the way that poetry historically has resonated with Iranians, as with Arabs and Indians and so forth, I don't want to privilege Iranians, then poetry has had this tremendous impact. And also keep in mind that poetry, as you know, is an open-ended, is an opera aperta, as Umberto Eco says, is not legislation, is not constitution of a society. It is the daydreaming of a society. As a result, its open-endedness is always leaves room for political, social, historical, intellectual developments that are always ahead of its institutional achievements.
Tell me about the role of expatriate intellectuals in the whole evolution of what you could call modernity in Iran.
Well, as you know, one of the provocative propositions I make in the book is that, in fact, the very term Iran as a nation is a term invented from its periphery, by Iranian intellectuals who went, for example, in the middle of the 19th century to Istanbul or to Central Asia, or by travelers who traveled all the way to Europe, or by foreign emissaries who traveled into Iran. So people traveling outside Iran, from Iran towards Central Asia or Asia Minor, or ultimately to Europe, or to India for that matter, began to define the space at the center of their moral and creative imagination, call it Iran. So that's a sort of a theoretical proposition I make. But historically, we have always had intellectuals in exile because they couldn't speak and write and publish freely inside Iran, that they lived for example, say in Istanbul, throughout the 19th century, the Ottoman Empire was a more intellectually enriching and also politically a more convenient place for particularly expatriate intellectuals to live and teach and make a modest living and also to translate, for example, and write their own works. For example, the translation of Marx and Darwin into Persian took place throughout the middle to late 19th century by these expatriate intellectuals who lived in Istanbul, taught Persian and Arabic at very elementary level, made a meager living, but led a very, very important life in terms of producing a moral, imaginative, and intellectual atmosphere within which the ideals and aspirations of the constitutional revolution and subsequently other developments in the 20th century took shape. So one of the ideas I propose is a kind of a crescent that extends from Central Asia, the southern steppes of Russia, from, say, Tajikistan to Armenistan, down to the Ottoman territories, to Egypt. Say, from Egypt to Tajikistan, which is a terra incognita. I don't know how in Australia you imagine this part of the world. Because usually we divide the world into East and West. Here is the East and here is the West, and the twain shall never meet. Whereas I'm trying to posit alternative sites of moral and intellectual imagination, such as the Mediterranean basin itself, which you really cannot divide it between East and West. As an economic and a political unit, it has a life of its own. But adjacent to the Mediterranean basin, what I'm offering is a territory that extends from Tajikistan to Egypt. And it's a fantastic period, middle of the 19th century. There are intellectuals, political activists, revolutionaries are fighting against, in fact, three simultaneously corrupt dynasties, the Russians, the Ottomans, and the Qajars in Iran. And these intellectuals are, by and large, multilingual. They speak Arabic, they speak Persian, they speak Turkish, they speak Russian, and they have some command of European languages, perhaps French or English, by virtue of the colonial presence of these countries in the region. And what they do, there is a synergy in the region. They read each other's work, they translate each other's work, they begin to translate works from Russian, from French, from English into Arabic, Persian, and Turkish, the three dominant languages. And throughout the 19th century, what I'm suggesting is when we mark something like the Russian Revolution or the Young Turk Revolution in Ottoman territories, or the Constitutional Revolution of 1906-1911, the breeding ground for these ideas and political movements is really not a westernization, is something regional. In which European literature, particularly socialist literature and nationalist literature, has a tremendous presence and impact. But more important than that is the creation of what I call a cosmopolitan culture, multilingual cosmopolitan culture, that is the most immediate breeding ground of these social and political movements.
Well, on The Book Show with me, Ramona Koval, on ABC Radio National, I'm speaking with Professor Hamid Dabashi, Professor of Iranian Studies and Comparative Literature at Columbia University in New York, and the author of Iran, A People Interrupted. Now, can we talk a little bit about you, Hamid, because you describe what you call a cosmopolitan worldliness in the air when you were growing up in the Pahlavi period. I think you were born in 1951, weren't you?
Yes.
So you say you were neither Islamist nor anti-Islamist. Give us the flavor of growing up.
Well, this part of my book, which is very memory based, and I try to place the significance of memory in writing of history. In effect, I'm giving my own example, an example of my own generation, by way of opposing this bifurcation, this dichotomy, this binary opposition that we ordinarily make between an Islamist and a secularist. So you are either an Islamist or a religiously musical, as Max Weber called it, or you're a secularist. What I'm proposing is that, in fact, reality is a bit more complex than that. And the word that for me is far more satisfying, the concept that is far more satisfying, is cosmopolitan, in which religious factors are present. There are certain elements in your character, in your culture, in your sentiments, that you cannot account for them rationally, logically, by virtue of your education or anything of that sort. And yet they are extremely important. And then, at the same time, you're exposed to the most progressive ideas that have come to you from around the world. And without discounting the significance of Western European literary and scientific texts that were translated and brought into countries such as Iran, I want to open the window to include, for example, things that came from Russia, or things that came from China, or things that came from India. India has historically been a far more important a factor and a culture and a civilization in the radar of countries such as Iran, in the moral and intellectual radar of countries such as Iran. But the people never talk about them because a place like India, because we are trapped inside the East-West, secular-religious kind of a dichotomy. Within that cosmopolitan culture, you really cannot identify a person's character or religious disposition, etc., because it depends on time of the day. I give, for example, my own father's case, who, depending on time of the month, he worked for a Iranian railroad. He was a worker. He was a wage earner, and he was a socialist, Nasserite socialist, in certain time of the month. Then he was a nationalist, Mossadegh, follower of Mossadegh, in certain other time of the month, and also a staunch nationalist in other occasions. And he never prayed. He never observed any religious law.
He drank Russian vodka.
Russian vodka while he was cooking for us. And whereas my mother was a very, very pious woman, and the two of them were lovingly attracted to each other, raised three children, and very, very happy together to their dying days. So in the figure of these two, my own parents, I provide an example that you cannot really say. There is a sort of a Nasserite socialist attracted to a very pious woman. And that pious woman also attracted to a man who drank Russian vodka. And she, my mother, never touched alcohol. To her, it was religiously forbidden. But yet they had a very loving, caring, wonderful, splendid life together.
I just want you to talk a little bit about also how you were interested in movies, of course, Indian musicals or even Charlie Chaplin movies.
Exactly. That is... In my childhood, there were a varieties of cultural domains, ranging, for example, from Indian musicals to Egyptian musicals to Hollywood musicals, and then to Charlie Chaplin, which was the most important factor. If I were to name one person who was crucial in my entire childhood, my generation's childhood, is Charlie Chaplin. And you will drop any religious obligation, you will drop any national obligation, any political commitment for the latest Charlie Chaplin that had made it to an Iranian movie theater. And one of the things that I try to do in the book is one cannot dismiss this as accidental. But in fact, they are the signpost of a topography of emotions and commitments and thoughts and sentiments that collectively make a person, a generation, and thus a people. And I give, for example, soccer. Soccer had a far more compelling significance for my generation of people. If Pele from Brazil said that the earth was flat, we believe the earth was flat. We couldn't care less what the sciences... my point is to map out a topography and give credence and legitimacy to aspects of life that otherwise are discounted or dismissed or considered accidental. To me, they are not accidental. And the other things that I did, again, along these lines, I break the taboo of illiteracy. You recall that I give an example of my own mother.
Your mother, yes.
Yeah, that who was illiterate. Namely, she could not read or write. But she would sit me down and dictate to me letters to the governor of Khuzestan about political matters that concerned her. And then I will read back to her what she had dictated to me, and she will make grammatical corrections. No, put a full stop there and take that comma out and things of that sort. So illiteracy... yet if you put a newspaper in front of her, she couldn't read or she couldn't write a letter. But illiteracy didn't mean the absence of social participation.
So where did she get her information from, that she would make decisions about what she thought politically important?
From a variety of sources. So far as her religious concerns were the issue, we had a blind mullah who used to come to our home and sing the praises of the saints and such. But also he, the mullah, was very politically active and very politically conscious. And then radio was another source of information and such. And then neighborhood mothers who came together and spoke about the varieties of issues. And then movies that they went together and saw and discussed and so forth. So there is a full spectrum of social participation in which they all were integral, and in which they participated. and politically, socially, culturally, etc. And this, the range of it, for example, goes from folkloric stories or stories about kings and saints and so forth. And then my point is that our emotive universe, the way that we react to things, the way that we configure ideas in the most bizarrest way. For example, I'm in my kitchen in New York and I'm cooking for my own kids, and I suddenly remember the way my father stood in our kitchen. And now I like Chablis, I drink Chablis, but he didn't know what Chablis was. He drank Russian vodka. But it's the same thing. It is the way that our cultural habits are formed, or our emotive universe are articulated. They are rooted in certain habits, in certain invisible traits in our upbringing, that we usually personalize them, individualize them. Whereas my attempt in the book has been to, in fact, to go the other way and turn them into parameters of our understanding of society and culture and politics beyond a mere sort of personal recollections. Perhaps the most ambitious thing that I have tried to do theoretically in the book is the translation and transmutation of the personal into the public.
Yes, I'm speaking with Hamid Dabashi about his book Iran, A People Interrupted, and you're on The Book Show with me, Ramona Koval, on ABC Radio National. It was interesting when I see you say, when we read Steinbeck or Hemingway, Dostoevsky or Turgenev, Stendhal or Dickens, there was no sense that we were reading from Western literature. How come?
Yep. Because it was literature. East and West meant nothing. We read them, first of all, in beautiful, impeccable, and wonderful, wonderful Persian, translated for us by world-class translators. So when we picked up Dickens, or in my case, my favorite were Russians and American novelists, the emotive universe and the moral and imaginative disposition that these novels generated in us, they were communicated in Persian. Of course, the translations were impeccable, very correctly and nicely done. But nevertheless, one book you read, for example, Dostoevsky today, next month you might be reading Stendhal, next month you might be reading Faulkner. So when all of these came together, they generated a topography in your imagination that you really didn't... What does it mean that Steinbeck is Western? Western in what sense? That is, there was a horizontal way in which literature communicated, and in a way linked to our own literature, the way that Iranian poets and novelists and playwrights and filmmakers were influenced by these writers, that didn't really make sense. There is a great Iranian filmmaker, I'm sure your audience in Australia knows him, Amir Nadiri, who once told me that Melville has been far more important in my cinema than the entire course of Persian literature.
Mm.
But he said, but I can't have that kind of... disappointing ending. I need a smidgen of hope at the end of my films. So in that topography, it's like you just can't divide the world along those lines. And then a division that is alienating, that suddenly Steinbeck or Dostoevsky, they belong to some other people, and you're eavesdropping when you take pleasure in reading them. We never felt we were eavesdropping when we were reading them.
Well, of course, things changed when you grew up a little bit. Tell us about the Savak book list you discovered when you became a university student.
Oh, that's a splendid story, isn't it? This is the story of when I moved from my hometown, Ahvaz, and came to Tehran to go to college, because there was only one college in my hometown, Ahvaz, and it was no good, and I wanted to go to Tehran. And I ended up with this list in my hand. The list was called Liste Kotobe Zalle, the list of books that will misguide you. And on it, there were a list of books that for the remaining 4 years that I was in Tehran, they were my core curriculum. These were the books that I actually read. I mean, they were not very easy to find, very difficult to find.
What were they?
Well, again, I give some list of them in terms of the books that would be familiar to you. What would be, let's see... My Universities by Maxim Gorky, Mother by Maxim Gorky, Mother Courage by Bertolt Brecht. We had Germinal by Emile Zola. We had Grapes of Wrath by John Steinbeck.
And these were they're supposed to be bad for you because?
Because they were political. And I said at the end that even Hamlet was forbidden, because in Hamlet, the student killed the king. And we might get ideas. Yes, they were political. They were, you know, they were considered dangerous, that people will get ideas for reading them.
How should we think, you know, and we're running out of time, and, there's a lot in this book that we won't be able to talk about. It was interesting to read, though, about you talking about the Salman Rushdie affair of 1989. How do you think we should think about that? Because you imply we should see it as a kind of sideshow.
It was a sideshow. It was a smokescreen. When it happened, you have to have the chronology correct. The initial reactions to Salman Rushdie's satanic verses were actually in England, by Muslim communities in England, that first the book was first published, and then in Pakistan, when Muslims demonstrated, and then one or two persons were killed during the demonstrations. So the origin of the controversy has absolutely nothing to do with Iran or Khomeini. But when the controversy took place, Khomeini took advantage of it. Very much like the hostage crisis. He didn't have anything to do with taking Americans hostage in their own embassy. But when it happened, he was the master of using the situation. It's sort of improvisatory politics. And in the case of the Salman Rushdie affair, he issued this fatwa against him. And this fatwa, 1989-1990, came exactly at a time, historically, when the Iran-Iraq war had ended and the heir designate to his rule had fallen from grace, a man named Ayatollah Montazeri. And Khomeini needed to change the constitution in order to make sure that a lower-ranking cleric can succeed him. And the Salman Rushdie affair became a perfect distraction. The world's attention was all towards this particular issue. And he masterfully managed to redraft the constitution, make sure that the Islamic Republic will endure. And then when the thing was done, then the question of Salman Rushdie's fatwa became a moot question.
You are a critic of Islam. I mean, and you've said that the religion needs to do a lot of soul searching, and you've said that there's nothing wrong with changing the regime in Iran. You've called it the Islamic Republic a horrid theocracy with a treacherous record of human rights abuses, and as well as denigration and denial of women's rights and civil rights. And your own position, though, is an interesting one. You're an Iranian-American who lives in America. You've lived in America for longer than you lived in Iran, after all. You teach at an Ivy League university. You're a cosmopolitan. You have a deep love and respect for the literatures of both European and other Western traditions. You're not enamoured of the American intentions to colonise either. I mean, how would you characterise your position?
My own position, as you said, I am a citizen of the United States from Iran. I have deep love and admiration for the country from which I come, and I have deep love and admiration for the country in which I live and in which my children are born. And as a result, as a person with deep respect for nations and for their aspirations, I simply oppose imperialism. I oppose people going halfway around the globe and shoving the best things, including democracy, down people's throats. And this puts certain people in a position of advantage and certain other people in a position of disadvantage, which morally and politically I oppose. I think Iraqis or Iranians or Afghans themselves are perfectly capable of making these changes. And if they pose a danger for international community, we have international organizations to take care of them. So I, when I speak against the American imperialism, or I speak against the Islamic Republic, I speak from a position of person deeply connected to the people of these countries, but opposed to their policies and to their politics and to their regimes and to their interfering in people's affairs. If, for example, Iranians are interfering in Iraqi affairs, they should not, and they must be stopped. But who's the blame? Certainly not United States, and if I may add here, certainly not Australia.
You You, though, have been the subject of quite widespread attacks, haven't you, from
yes.
in the US. Can you, in the last couple of minutes or 1 minute or so, can you tell us what happened?
Well, the attacks that come my way are because of my stand, for example, in defense of Palestinians or against the Iraq war. And it's a lively, I mean, I don't feel victimized. I feel part of a thriving political culture. I'm very blessed to live in the United States. If I set foot in the Islamic Republic of Iran, I'll be sent to jail. And I'm part of a national and global struggle. I criticize certain things, and I am criticized. My position vis-a-vis the question of Palestine, I'm for one nation. I'm not for continued colonial domination of Palestinians, or I'm opposed to Iraq war. I was opposed to Afghan invasion. And these positions are, as they say in this country, controversial. But I really don't, it doesn't matter to me. What matters to me is I feel integral to not only an American, but a global struggle. People who think like me and support me and endorse me. So there are as many people, there are more, in fact, people who endorse me and support me and lend their endorsement to what I say and are my friends, colleagues, and comrades than those who oppose me. And those who oppose me, I don't vilify them. We just have different points of view about matters.
Well, it's been very interesting speaking with you this morning, Hamid Dabashi. Thank you so much for being on The Book Show.
Thanks for having me.
And Hamid Dabashi's book, Iran, A People Interrupted, is out now, and it's published by the New Press of New York and London. And now let's go to one of our major revolutionaries on Radio National, Michael McKenzie.
I believe in freedom and liberty.
Well, that's good. Hmm. Did you know something? Just before you tell us what's coming up on Bush Telegraph, I've just read this piece in the Los Angeles Times that apocalyptic literature is the thing that we're going to be reading now. A whole lot of books are looking at the end of the world.
Well, I mean, I think that's been a strong thread in my upbringing anyway. I mean, I'm not sure about you, but I loved Catcher in the Rye.
That was
personal
that.
Apocalypse.
Yeah. Apocalypse Now.
Yes, indeed, for the personal sort of boy who didn't know what to do with growing up.
Now it's what do we do with the end of the world? I think it's all about post 9/11 and the Iraq war.
And it's also all about, to a degree these days, climate change. And some people aren't being so apocalyptic about it, Ramona. This is a lovely segue.
Go on. Because, I'm really enjoying it. Yeah, I don't know where you're going.
Yeah,
with
no, neither
it,
do
I'm,
I.
I'm on the ride.
Lovely, thank you. Bush Heritage Australia is actually launching today the first piece in the puzzle that's the corridor linking Kosciuszko and the coast. And this high country corridor is going to be an area of protected bush for generations to come, particularly of flora and fauna in that region who need high country during climate change.
Good.
Yeah. I'll explain more about it.
I can't quite visualize
it. It's like a high country
though.
Arc, if you like.
So, yeah. So all the animals are going along a little path.
That's right, with their backpacks and lederhosen. Yeah.
Good.
Also, we're heading off to Esperance in WA today to find out about last night's public meeting, which was held to voice concerns over levels of lead in the environment of Esperance, which started 18 months ago in conjunction with lead exports to Asia. And there's something like 4,000 birds reported dead due to lead poisoning in the last few months, and a lot of the community naturally is very concerned about
what it
means.
They must be very scared about it.
Yeah,
must
so
be.
We'll be crossing live to Esperance for that story.
Good on you. All right, then Michael McKenzie on Bush Telegraph coming up after 11 o'clock. And on tomorrow's book show, our man in Asia, Nuri Vitacci, author and editor of the Asia Literary Review, will join us not from Hong Kong where he lives and where he usually is, but from India with literary news from the region. We'll also be talking about the National Biography Awards, which are being announced tonight. And a conversation we'll hear also with Edie Turner, who at 85 looks back on her life as an anthropologist. So that's on The Book Show tomorrow at 10 a.m. Go to our website, abc.net.au/rn/bookshow, and you can download this program as a podcast, and you can find today's guest and book details there too. That's all from me, Ramona Koval. Shortly, the ABC Radio National News, and I'll see you tomorrow.
You've You've been listening to another ABC Radio National podcast. ABC Radio National, on air and online, with many of our programs available as podcasts or MP3 downloads. All the details at abc.net.au/rn/podcast.